name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 172. I'm recording it on Monday, September 28th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 19. That's high. The long-term value proposition of stocks today is somewhat dubious. The musical selection is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. It's entitled Winter Reflections. The title of the podcast is 30 Investment Myths in 60 Minutes. I decided to have a bit of fun with myself with this one. When I used to work at Daily Tax Report, we had a 6 o'clock deadline. You had to turn your article in by 6 o'clock because the publication had to be printed up in the printer. We had a printer. And it had to be put on the plane, and everybody wanted to see it the next morning when they got to work, whatever. And some of these people got to work early in the morning, 7 in the morning. So it had to get on the plane at a certain time or it wasn't going to make it. So you had a 6 o'clock was a pretty hard deadline to get it to the editors. And it used to make me laugh that if I would start an article at 9:30 in the morning, I would turn it in at 5 minutes to 6. And if I started an article at 5:30 in the afternoon, I would turn it in at 5 minutes to 6. So it can be done. Rob can do things with, Rob can do things without taking, 84 minutes. So what I decided to do here was I scribbled down 30 investment myths that I think cause people trouble. And I made a challenge to myself. I'm going to cut the mic off at 60 minutes. And if I only get through the first 6, too bad. But all those people who can't bear the thought of listening to a podcast for 60 or 70 minutes or whatever I usually go, can pick up all this great information that the Retire Early and Indexing Discussion Board communities have developed over the past 7 years in one 60-minute podcast. At least that's the theory. Let's see how it goes. I better get going. 30 investment myths in 60 minutes. I've got 2 minutes of myth. All right. Number one, passive investing is scientific. This is how they try to sell it to us. Taylor Larimore will say all the time, they'll say, why can't we allow discussion of other investing ideas at this board? And he'll say, well, ours is based on the academic research. Our ideas are scientific. They're better than the other ideas. Well, there's truth in that. Some of the most destructive myths are the ones that have truth in them because it makes them plausible. They have enough truth to be plausible. And I have a separate podcast just on this subject of whether today's conventional investing wisdom is scientific or not. I don't recall the name of it, but if you look for scientific in the list of podcasts or Robcast, you will find it. It was an early one, I think. Bringing science, bringing objectivity into the investing world was a big deal, a great idea. And while passive investing has caused a lot of trouble, it's also generated a lot of powerful insights. The insights it has generated is the result of the fact that it does have this scientific side to it. Because otherwise, investing advice is just all over the map. You've got three experts and they've got three totally different views of what's going on. And what's the middle class investor to do? You have no idea who to believe. When you make it objective, when you use numbers, you can tie things down. You can actually make progress. The problem is, more important than the science, yes, there is science in passive investing. There's no question. They do use academic research. But more dominant is their desire to market product, to sell stocks. And so what's happened is they did base passive investing on the academic research of the 1950s and 60s and 70s. But in 1981, Yale professor Robert Shiller came out with research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. And there's been much research confirming that in the decades since. And they didn't want to abandon passive investing because from a marketing standpoint, it's so powerful. So what we have today is the opposite of science in passive investing. We don't have science because science is a quest for truth. when you put marketing above science, marketing is a quest to persuade, regardless of whether it's true. It's an attempt to persuade through emotion. So what we have today is not science, not objective truth. We have marketing-driven pseudoscience, pretend science. It looks like science. It's got charts and tables and numbers and all this sort of thing. But it's rooted in a model that's been discredited for nearly three decades. So passive investing is not science. That's an investing myth that will get you into a lot of trouble if you don't know about it. I'm behind, about 5 minutes behind already. Myth number two, passive investing is rooted in academic research. Well, lucky me, I already discussed that in the first myth. So I'm going to skip right on. I'm going to catch up on 2 minutes. Myth number three, stock prices are set by a random number generator in the sky. I swear this is what people think. It's clear when you listen to what people say about investing at discussion boards that there are millions of people today who think stock returns are generated by a random number generator in the sky. There was one that came up this morning. It blew my mind a little bit. I get my mind blown all the time when involved in investing discussions. But somebody was talking, and these people were totally sincere. It was at the Digirati Life blog, and she had done a blog entry praising dollar cost averaging. And I said dollar cost averaging is a bad idea, but she was fine. She allows people to give different viewpoints. So she's a straight shooter. But several people came on and they were praising dollar cost averaging, and that's also fine. It's good that they express their viewpoints. But I just don't understand where it comes from. If you're dollar cost averaging, you're buying stocks sometimes at good prices and sometimes at bad prices. Why do people think that's a good idea? If there were three car dealers in your area and one sold the car at fair value and one sold it below fair value where you could get a great deal and the other one sold it far above fair value where he's ripping you off, would people say, well, your goal should be to try to buy an equal number of cars at all three dealers because one is ripping you off and one's giving you a fair deal and one's giving you a super great deal. And so you want to divide your business, buy one car, you know, and then the next to switch to the other dealer for the second car and then the other one the third. Why the heck would you do that? What you want to do is buy at good prices. So dollar cost averaging makes no sense. Dollar cost averaging means mixing it up, sometimes buying at good prices, sometimes bad, sometimes in the middle. No, the idea is to buy at the best prices available. That's valuation-informed indexing. So dollar cost averaging makes no sense in Rob Bennett's opinion, and it gets you thinking. It causes you to develop a mindset that's really dangerous, that all prices are the same when it comes to buying stocks. And we spend more money buying stocks than we spend buying anything else in the course of our lifetimes. So if you're ignoring price, if you're paying attention to price, if you're a frugal person trying to achieve financial freedom early in life and you're paying attention to price when you buy comic books and bananas and cars and you're not doing it when you buy stocks, that's mixed up. Myth number four, the experts in the stock selling industry are not influenced by the fact that they make millions promoting passive investing. Well, the way I state the myth, I guess, reveals my take on it. I think they are influenced. And people just don't seem to stop and think about this. I often say the reason why passive investing is so popular is because it's been promoted so heavily. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent. You know, these glossy magazines and, you know, Money Magazine. It's a good publication. There's a lot of good stuff in it. But you don't think it influences them that 90% of their advertising is from the stock selling industry? You don't think that they want to please that industry? And that industry, of course, wants to sell stocks regardless of how overpriced they are? You don't think that influences the editorial coverage? In any other field of human endeavor, you know, when you get one of those pullout, did you ever get a pullout supplement in your newspaper that got some pullout on health or some pullout on cars? And they've got articles on one side of the page and the other side is ads, and you know darn well that they're influenced. Everybody gets that. It's just, you know, in theory, they're not supposed to influence the front page, and they probably influence that too to some extent, but they're not supposed to. But the idea that they're not influenced by the advertising, come on. Well, we think it's any different when selling stocks. So why do we, it's not that we shouldn't listen to the experts in the stock selling industry. They're smart, great people. John Bogle's taught me a lot. Bill Bernstein's taught me a lot. Scott Burns, Jonathan Clements, all these people. But I know that they're influenced. Now, I didn't know it before. I didn't know it before the Great Save Withdrawal Rate debate, but I know it now after I've seen the reactions when you ask them to fix, you know, the numbers in the retirement studies and they don't want to do it. It's clear that they're influenced. That doesn't mean that they're dishonest, but it means that they are influenced. In other words, when you're in, you know, when you work for Coke, you start thinking Coke is better than Pepsi. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. When you work for Pepsi, you think Pepsi's better. And a lot of times you really believe it because your whole living depends on it being true. And we all want to be good people, you know, promoting good things. So we persuade ourselves of these things. Well, we need to have a counter to the advice we hear from those employed in the stock selling industry in Rob Bennett's opinion. Myth number 5, investors are engaged in the rational pursuit of their self-interest. This one came up just today at the Oblivious Investor blog. Mike Piper, who writes that blog, had a comment where he talked about, he said, oh, if any timing strategy came up that worked, it would be instantly, it would no longer work. Once people knew about it, people would jump in and use it, and the edge would be gone. It would no longer work. And people, passive investors, say this all the time, this idea that you can't beat the market and that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, if investors were engaged in the rational pursuit of their self-interest, that's true. That does logically follow, but you have to presume rationality. In other words, if investors were rational, they would see valuation-informed indexing. Millions would jump in and start doing it. It's not that valuation-informed indexing would no longer work. It would certainly still work, but it would dominate. It would passive investing would be overcome. And everybody would become a valuation-informed indexer. And the benefit, today, valuation-informed indexers get far more than 6.5 returns because the passive investors pull the average down, and the average is 6.5. So valuation-informed indexers are getting much more. If everyone became a valuation-informed indexer, you really would get only 6.5. But what's wrong with that? That's fine. That doesn't mean the benefits have gone away. 6.5 is a wonderful return. And we would do it without all the angst that's involved in all this crazy up and down movement in the stock market. So that would be a very good thing. But it's not true that investors are engaged in the rational pursuit of their self-interest. Investors don't want to know the realities of stock investing. Millions of them, some want to know, but millions of them love hearing this passive investing stuff because it flatters them. It tells them, hey, you didn't get those insane returns in the 90s because of just luck. You got them because you were so smart. You knew to invest passively. And people love hearing that stuff. They eat it up with a fork and spoon. They're appealing to the most base human emotions. And, you know, we're all influenced. What do you think advertising is? Advertising is premised on the idea that we're emotional, not fully rational. You don't think there's advertising of stock strategies? We're not rational. We have a rational side, but we're not totally rational. And any investing theory, presuming that we are, is going to get you in trouble. It's going to lead you to the wrong place. Investing myth number 6, gains are better than losses. Boy, there was a guy, I don't know if I can remember his name quickly, Wolffinger. His last name is Wolffinger, but I can't think of his first name. Mark Wolffinger. He has a blog, the Options Rookie, I think it's called. And I put up a post at Weconomist blog, I think this was Friday, saying, maybe Thursday, saying investors are better to have losses than to have gains in the early years of their investing lifetime. It's only when you retire that you want to see gains. Because why is this is not, it's not my opinion. This could be mathematically demonstrated. Say you're 35 and you're going to be investing for 30 years. And say that, the long-term return of stocks in the U.S. has been 6.5 real for a long, long time. Let's presume that holds. Productivity is going to stay roughly the same for the next 3 decades. So you're going to get 6.5 as your annualized real return over 30 years. Are you better if in the next 10 years stocks go up 100%, or are you better if they go down 50%? The answer is you're better if they go down 50%. because you're going to be buying stocks every year during those 10 years. And if you're going to get the 6.5, as long as you get the 6.5 annualized return, the initial investment, the amount you have in stocks today, you're going to end up with the same return on that money. So whether they go up or down over the next 10 years makes no difference. You end up in the same place. But on all the shares you'll be buying from this day forward, you're better if the prices are lower. So if prices go down 50% over the next 10 years, you're sitting pretty. You're going to end up with at the end of 30 years, a far higher portfolio than if they went up. And this is just a mathematical fact. And Marv Wolfinger, he went nuts. He was angry at me for pointing this out. He was extremely hostile. And he's a smart guy, not saying different. It shows how dominant emotion is in this field. People are not capable of thinking clearly or rationally. And that obviously hurts us all. And, you know, I think we all need to work together to help each other think rationally and clearly, at least on numerical calculations. If we can't think clearly about numerical calculations, we really have a problem because, you know, there shouldn't be any hostility when somebody presents the result of a mathematical calculation. It's a mathematical fact that middle-class investors are better if prices go down than if they go up they go down in the short term. We should all be applauding when prices go down, because every time they go down, that means they're going to go up more in the future. And that's good, because it means we buy more shares at low prices, but we still get all the rewards of the price increases in the end. It's a net positive when prices go down. It's a net negative when prices go up. And so much of our thinking on stocks is wrongheaded because we don't get this. We think of ourselves as buyers should want prices to go down. And we think of ourselves, we are buyers. Middle-class investors are buyers of stocks, and we think of ourselves as sellers. This is why the whole market doesn't work. We've got it all backwards. We've got it upside down. Myth number 7. All losses are the same. All gains are the same. Well, no, they're not. People talk about them as if they are. If you lost money from in the crash, when stock valuations were somewhere around the high 20s, P10 level of around 29 before the crash began, and at the low they ended up at 12, P10 level of 12. Well, say from a P10 level of say you lost money, lost a lot of money, and then at 12 we went back up again. But say we continued down to 6. Be half a fair value. Were all those losses the same? They were not. The fall from 29 down to 14, that's a permanent loss because that money never existed in the first place. It was when the P10 level is above 14, stocks are overvalued. What does it mean to be overvalued? It means not to be valued properly. So if you pay more than fair value, all you're doing when you lose money is you're giving up money that never existed. You're just giving up cotton candy nothingness. You're never going to get it back. It's a permanent loss. But if we go from 14 down to 7, that's not a permanent loss. That's just a temporary loss. That's undervaluation, which means that in time, prices are going to go back to fair value. And when they go back to fair value, you make all that up. It's just a temporary loss. It's like a nice little time period where you get to buy more stocks at low prices. But the loss is insignificant. It's just a short-term thing. But the loss from before the crash to the crash, that was real. You'll never get that money back. That was because you were a passive investor. That's the price of irrational investing. You were investing heavily in stocks at times when the long-term value proposition was poor. So you have to distinguish the different types of losses and gains. Some gains are only in place for a short number of years, and other gains will stay around forever. Some losses, same thing. You've got to distinguish if you want to make sense of stock investing. Myth number 8, stocks are always best for the long term. No. Read the book Stock Cycles, right in the subtitle. Michael Alexander wrote that book. I have a podcast on that book. And right in the subtitle, I thought it was a bold subtitle. I can't quote it exactly, but he essentially says, why money markets are going to beat stocks over the next 20 years. You know, all these people say, oh, whoever thought we were going to have a stock crash like this? Oh, so unanticipated. It wasn't unanticipated by Michael Alexander. He saw it. He wrote that book a long time ago. I don't know how many years. Sometime around 2000. I don't know the exact date. So years in advance, he saw that coming. And he said stocks are going to return less than money markets for 20 years. So he's not saying stocks are going to do bad next week, or stocks are going to do bad next month, or stocks are going to do bad next year. He's saying stocks are going to do bad over the long term. 20 years is the long term. The truthful way of saying it is stocks are more predictable in the long term. That's fair to say. They are more predictable in the long term. But sometimes predictably good, sometimes predictably bad. The reason that we're told so often that they're predictably good is that we're listening to the stock selling industry for our tips. And they're saying, oh yeah, always buy stocks, just like a car dealer would tell you always buy cars and a book dealer tells you always buy books. Stocks are not always better in the long run. They are often better in the long run. They're sometimes worse in the long run. They are more predictable in the long run, sometimes predictably good, sometimes predictably bad. Investment myth number 9 of 30. Timing doesn't work. The whole premise of valuation-informed indexing is that timing does work. It's not even possible that timing wouldn't work. You know what timing is? Timing is paying attention to price. To time the market is to change your stock allocation at different times, right? That's what it means. Well, if you don't time the market, you're not paying attention to price. You're just buying the same amount of, you're going with the same stock allocation at all prices. Does that make any sense? Is there any asset you can buy on planet Earth where paying attention to price doesn't work? Just change the language. Don't let these linguistic games, these word games that the stock selling industry engages in fool you. When they say timing doesn't work, what they're really saying is paying attention to price doesn't work. And who do you think benefits from that message? The people selling us stocks, not the middle class investor. Timing always works. Paying attention to price always works. That doesn't mean you have to time every day. It just means you always have to look at the price before you buy stocks. And when the price is good, you should, of course, buy. And when the price is bad, you should avoid buying. You should not buy stocks when the price is bad. Timing always works, and the historical data shows this to be true. They get away with saying timing never works because there's a lot of evidence that in the short term, timing doesn't work. But in the long term, the evidence is the timing always works. So it's every bit as true a statement to say timing always works as it is to say timing never works. Investment myth number 10, stocks are more risky than bonds. I don't buy it. I have a podcast with this title that goes into it in depth. Stocks, it says stocks are less risky than bonds. Well, stocks are highly predictable 20 years out. You can do a statistical test. And if you look at the PE10 level on the day you buy stocks, that tells you 78% of what you need to know to predict the price that applies in 20 years. That's a high level of predictability. Bonds, I don't think, are 78% predictable. I haven't done the test, but given the effect of inflation on bond values, I find it hard to believe they'd be 78% predictable. Well, unpredictability is risk. So if stock prices are more predictable than bond prices 20 years out, stocks are less risky than bonds. I don't see how you can argue otherwise, really. The only argument you can make is that this is true. If you don't pay attention to price, stocks are more risky than bonds. Because if you don't pay attention to price, you have no idea what your long-term return is going to be. If you don't pay attention to price, if you're a passive investor, you might get a great return on your stocks. You might get a horrible return on your stocks. So yes, if you don't pay attention to price, then bonds are less risky. But what if you do pay attention to price? There's no law that says you can't, is there? If you pay attention to price, it seems to me, stocks are less risky than bonds. Investment myth number 11 goes even farther. I argue that stocks are less risky. If I said stocks are more risky than bonds in number 10, I meant to say they're less risky than bonds. I hope I said it properly. I wrote it improperly, looking at my notes. Number 11, stocks are less risky than cash. That one is a more dubious statement, but I think it's true. Risk is not volatility. Risk is losing money. And if you know what you're doing when you're buying stocks, you shouldn't be losing money. It certainly is true that if you buy a money market account, you can cash it in tomorrow. So in that sense, you're not going to lose a lot of capital. If you're not happy with the return, you just cash it in. But if you know what you're doing with stocks, you shouldn't be losing money with stocks either. Because depending on the PE10 level, you can calculate how long it's going to take before the likelihood is very high that that your stock portfolio will be worth what it was when you started. And if you buy at high prices, that's going to be very far into the future. Yeah, but that's your choice. It's not really a risk. It's a deliberate choice to invest poorly. But if you look at the price, if you buy when stocks are low priced or fairly priced, you don't usually have to go that long. You might have to go 5 years to be able to get your money back, or possibly 10 years. Is that risk? I don't think it's risk if you know going in that that's what it's going to take. If you buy stocks saying, in 10 years, I think I'm going to have a positive return, and you get a positive return within 10 years, is that risk? No. I don't call that risk anyway. You know, it's a semantics question. But if you know it going in, it's not risk. Passive investors, yes, they're taking on a lot of risk because they're pretending that valuations don't affect the equation, and they're leaving out the most important part of the equation. So they're deliberately blinding themselves to the realities. But rational investors don't take on that much risk when buying stocks, in Rob Bennett's opinion. So it's a very bold statement, but I think it can at least be argued that stocks are not necessarily more risky than cash. It is true that you have to wait longer with stocks to get your money back in some cases. But given that the return is so much higher, and I think of return as being anti-risk. In other words, part of the risk of a quote-unquote safe asset class is you become more and more desperate as time goes on because you're not getting a return. Whereas with stocks, if you purchase them intelligently, you can make enough, you know, in say the first 5 years of your investing lifetime, that you're ahead of the game and you're not going to be panicky anymore. But you will ultimately become panicky if you don't pay attention to valuations, because you will get to a point where you think your portfolio is so much more valuable than it is that you will panic when you lose it. Whereas if you adjust for valuations, you will always be reducing the value of that portfolio down to realistic terms, and panic won't enter the picture. So if you invest in stocks intelligently, I think it can be argued. I think a strong argument can be made that stocks are less risky than bonds. I think a tenable, you know, but not at all certain argument can be made that they're even less risky than money markets. That's more out there. But I'm willing to claim it. I'm willing to stand up on a stage and make the case, and people can decide whether they think that makes any sense or not. I admit that argument's out there. I don't deny that part. Myth 12, greater risk equals greater return. No. Just look at the stock return predictor. Stock return predictor reports what the historical stock return data tells us about how stocks will perform in the long term. Plug in a PE10 level of 8, and the most likely 10-year return on stocks is 15% real annualized. Plug in a PE10 level of 44, the PE10 level that applied at the top of the bubble, and the most likely 10-year return is a negative number. Negative number. TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, were providing 4% real at the top of the bubble. Which was more risky? An asset class where we were likely to see a crash was virtually inevitable, that was paying a negative number as its return, or an asset class that was paying 4% real and has a government guarantee attached? Risk does not equal return. Taking on risk does not ensure that you will get a good return on your funds. Does not. Risky asset classes are sometimes the worst asset classes you can put your money in. And at the top of the bubble, that was certainly true of stocks. Risk does not equal return. That's one of the central flaws of passive investing, that idea. Myth 13. Less return equals less risk. That's sort of the reverse of the above, but you know, I think that probably comes from that incredible conversation I had once with Larry Swedro, where he agreed with me that stocks at the top of the bubble were likely to provide a poor long-term return. But then he said, that's okay, because less less return equals less risk. So the implication was stocks were the safest asset class on planet Earth at the top of the bubble, and that's just crazy talk. It all follows logically from the passive investing theory. It all follows, but it's crazy. When you get your premise wrong, you get everything wrong. When you find out your premise is wrong, you gotta fix it. There's really no choice. Less risk, less return does not equal less risk. If anything, again, it makes you more panicky. Return should make you more secure. So less return is not less risk. Less return makes you more panicky, which means you're suffering from more risk in a real sense. Myth number 14. All young people should go with high stock allocations. Well, I strongly disagree. It's one of my pet peeves. People will say all the time, they'll say, oh yeah, valuations. Retirees have to be careful. If you're within 5 years of retirement, you got to be careful with stocks. But, oh, if you're in your 20s, just, you know, go with that high stock allocation. Make as much as you can. No, 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 no. 1,000 times no. This can be demonstrated mathematically. In the saving area, we have something called compounding returns phenomenon. And they point to it all the time. They tell young people, if you would just put some money away in savings, your compounding returns would grow so much. If you put $1 aside when you're 25, it's like $17 billion by the time you're 65. You got to put that money aside to get those compounding returns. Well, why doesn't that work in reverse? If you put your money in stocks at the valuation levels, if you're a young person and you put your money in stocks at the valuation levels that applied from 1996 through 2008 and you lose most of your money, don't you also lose the compounding returns on all that money? Sure seems so to me. So young people should not be throwing their money away on bad investing choices. Young people, I mean, retirees shouldn't be doing it either. I'm not saying they should. But retirees don't lose as much compounding as young people do. So the retirees have a risk young people don't, in that they don't have much time to make up for the losses. That's the risk, and that's real. That's a legitimate concern. But young people have a risk that old people don't, that they lose compounding. Years and years, decades of compounding if they make dumb investing decisions. So the idea that young people should just throw all their money into stocks regardless of whether stocks at the prices they're selling are a good value proposition or not is out to lunch idea. Myth number 15, all retirees should go with low stock allocations. Again, I don't buy it. A lot of people are living long lives today. They retire at 65 and they might live to 95. So they're going to be investing for 30 years. Why should they give up all the returns that are associated with stock investing? Maybe they should lower their allocation a bit. I can go along with that. But if they invest intelligently, if they invest in stocks at good prices, they're going to get good long-term returns. And that's, you know, maybe, you know, say they invest in stocks at a P10 level of 8 when they're 65. Because the long-term value proposition is so great. And maybe stocks go down for 3 years. Even from a P10 level of 8, you can have short-term drops. Okay, so they sweat a little bit for 3 years. But then they get those 15% real returns for 10 years, which is the most likely return at a P10 level of 8. And think, you know, they're not going to sweat again all the way to 95. So why not take advantage of that? If they put their money in these, you know, in CDs or whatever, you know, I love CDs, I love tips, I love I-bonds, but you're gonna help yourself more in stocks if they're priced well. So I don't buy the idea that retirees should avoid stocks. The risk is not buying stocks when you're retired. The risk is buying stocks without paying attention to price. That's the risk. Myth 16, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Well, I discussed that above. This is, you know, it's a shame. There's no such thing as a free lunch. There was a time when that statement probably served a good purpose, because it certainly is true. When you hear about a free lunch, you should be skeptical. Free lunch claims can get you into trouble. They're often used by, you know, salesmen, and you got to watch it. But the passive investors have taken that claim and turned it into a negative. Anytime anybody comes up with any advance in our understanding of how stock investing works, they jump in and they say, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You might as well say there's no such thing as education. There's no such thing as good health, you know. Don't bother eating well or exercising well. If that really helped you, it couldn't exist. There's no such thing as a free lunch. In other words, don't do anything positive in your life. Because anything positive, anything that could be shown to produce a good result is a free lunch. That's how they use that phrase today in Investo world. Paying attention to prices is not a free lunch. It's sensible. And it's what the historical data, it's what the academic research says we should be doing. So there is such a thing as a free lunch. Life is a free lunch. Life itself is a free lunch. We didn't earn this. It was given to us. We're all lucky to be here, and it's a free lunch, and we better start having some gratitude for it, and we certainly should have gratitude for the product of our intelligence. And the product of our intelligence is better ways to invest than what were state-of-the-art in the 1960s. We've gone past passive investing for three decades now, and we need to start sharing. We need to start telling each other about it and stop pretending that any advance in our understanding of how life works is a quote-unquote free lunch. No. Myth number 17. Mutual fund managers are seeking the best return as their first priority. No. Mutual fund managers, I'm sure they're good people, and I'm sure they're smart people, but they have job pressures like all the rest of us. So much of the literature, what they do in order to study, quote-unquote, what works, is they look at mutual fund managers. They say if mutual fund managers, the smartest people in the field, if they can't get good returns by picking individual stocks, nobody can. Well, guess what? Mutual fund managers are compromised. Their number one job is to get people to sign up for their mutual fund. That's what determines whether they keep their jobs or not. And their jobs pay millions, so they want to keep their jobs. Well, if you had a job as a mutual fund manager and you were making millions a year during the insane years from 96 through 2008, what would you do? You would go with a heavy stock allocation, even if the historical data told you that was a disaster for the fund. You would do what you had to do to keep your job. Most humans would. And if you didn't, you'd be booted out and you'd be replaced by somebody who would. So mutual fund managers are not the people we should be looking at. If you want to find out whether people can invest effectively by investing rationally, look at people who do it. Look at people who are independent of the sales pressures that are imposed on mutual fund managers. You as an individual investor have an edge that the mutual fund managers can never have. You can invest rationally and not get fired for doing it. So don't base your strategy on what the mutual fund managers do, for heaven's sakes. Myth 18. Investors want to know how to invest effectively. If investors want to know how to invest effectively, I put forward a post at Motley Fool, May 13, 2002, reporting on errors in the retirements, the studies we all use to plan our retirements. Many hundreds of people thanked me for doing that. But thousands of people objected, and honest posting on Safe Withdrawal Rates was banned at Motley Fool. Honest posting on Safe Withdrawal Rates was banned at IndexUniverse.com. Honest posting on Safe Withdrawal Rates was banned at Early Retirement Forum. Honest posting on Safe Withdrawal Rates was banned at the Free Money Finance blog. Honest posting on Safe Withdrawal Rates was banned at Bogleheads.org. Honest posting on Safe Withdrawal Rates was banned at Morningstar. Investors want to know how to invest effectively? They don't want to know the correct numbers. The numbers that the financial planners use to tell us how to plan our retirements, they're the product of a mathematical calculation. Not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of mathematical calculation. And there are thousands of investors don't want to know. And of course, if it's thousands on these discussion board communities, it's millions out in the world. Many, many, many investors don't want to know how to invest effectively. What they want is to be proven right. If they went with a high stock allocation at a time when it was foolish to do so, they want evidence that they were right. They feel insecure, they feel foolish, and they want to be proven right, and they don't want to hear about what works. This is the reality. Now, maybe telling people that isn't the best way to sell a book. In the long term, I hope it is, because we need to let reality in to discussions of investing. And the reality is, we are not robots with arms and legs. We don't all want to know how to invest effectively. What many of us want is to feel good about investing decisions we've already made. We are emotionally invested in stocks during insane bull markets, and all we want is to hear that we were right. Our common sense bugs us, our common sense scares us, and we want to clamp down on our common sense, and we want to be flattered with promises of get-rich-quick schemes. And that's what passive investing is, ultimately. Many of us do not want to know how to invest effectively. We should, and there's a part of us that does. And I think that the investing quote-unquote expert should be appealing to that part of us that wants to learn better. That should be the job of investing. The job should be to overcome this resistance to the realities. That's the job. It's a hard job. I know. I do it on a daily basis. It's a hard job, but that's the job. And just saying, oh, investors want to know how to invest effectively. No, that means you don't have to do the job. And if you don't do it, it's not going to happen. If you don't do it, people are going to keep making the same mistakes they've been making for years and years. Myth 19, the number of years until retirement tells you how many years you can wait for a good return. You know, what the passive investors will say is, you know, if you're going to need the money within 5 years, you know, stocks are dangerous. But if you're 35 and you're not going to retire until 65, then you don't have to worry about any losses from stocks. Now, there's one sense in which that's true. If you go 30 years out, stocks always provide a good long-term return. If you go 10 years out, that's not true. 15 years, that's not true. 20 years, that's not true. 25 years, not really true. 30 years, it is true. So what they do is they say, well, if you're not going to retire for 30 years, all you have to look at is the 30-year numbers. You don't have to worry your little head about what's going to happen in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years. And I say you do. Because none of us are only concerned about retirement. There are a lot of things we finance with money. If you're going to buy a house in 5 years, you want to know how much money you have in your account before you buy that house, because if your portfolio has been depleted, you're going to feel uneasy about taking on that debt. If you want to start a business within 10 years, you need to know that you've got a cushion. You might not be planning on taking the money out of your retirement portfolio to pay for the business. You keep them separate, but that doesn't mean that the size of the portfolio doesn't influence your thinking on whether it's safe to go off on this adventure or not. You need to know that you've got that cushion. If all else fails, you've got some money in reserve. But if that account has been wiped out, which it will most likely be wiped out if you invest at the prices that applied from 96 through 2008, you won't be able to start that business. So the fact that you weren't going to retire in 30 years, it doesn't matter if you're planning on starting a business in 10 years or buying a house in 5 years or having a son or a daughter going to college within 15 years. These are you need to plan when you're deciding on your investment allocation, your investment strategy. You need to think about not just what's going to happen in 30 years, what's going to happen in 5, 10, 15, 20. All these time periods matter. I don't want you to think that that means this gets complicated. You don't have to, you know, draft, you know, huge flow charts. But you need to know that it's not only 30 years that matters. That's what the stock selling industry wants you to think. Only think about 30 years. It's unrealistic. It's artificial. It's wrong. You don't want to be losing money at any of these stages. Yes, 30 years does matter. And the 30-year numbers are a plus for stocks. That's factual. That's true. It's ignoring the other side of the story that is the problem with these half-truths, these marketing slogans of the stock-selling industry. Rob Bennett's opinion. Myth 20. Passive investing is a neutral strategy. This one drives me crazy. I have here in parentheses, non-extreme. Passive investing is sold to people as the neutral, the fallback. And a lot of people don't spend a lot of time thinking through investing questions. So they're inclined to go with the fallback. And they feel, well, you know, yeah, this, you know, I see some people say valuations matter. Some people say not so much. But I'll just go with passive. That's the tried and true. No! Passive is the most extreme strategy imaginable. If you have somebody else in this room, I mean, I believe valuations matter. There's probably no one on planet Earth alive today who thinks valuations matter more than Rob Bennett does. So you could say I'm extreme if you want. I don't have a problem with that. But passive investing says make no adjustment for valuations. That's every bit as extreme as I am on the other side. So if you want to take a middle ground position, it's not passive investing. A middle ground position would be valuations matter and we need to change our stock allocations, but maybe they don't matter as much as Rob says. But if people understood that passive is extreme, we would have a range of opinions expressed every day on discussion boards and blogs and magazines and television and all this sort of thing. But what we get is 90% the most extreme stuff imaginable, and then 10% is, you know, the people who know what the academic research of the last 30 years says, giving their opinion, but we tune that out because we say, well, 90% agree. That's the mainstream. It's not. It's the mainstream during an insane bull market. That's all. The mainstream on stock investing advice changes. And when stocks are most dangerous, 90% are saying jump in with both feet. And when stocks offer the best long-term value proposition, 90% are saying take all your money out. And this causes the middle class to delay their retirements by many, many years. It's destructive to middle class efforts to accumulate wealth over time, that they're always doing the wrong thing because they're listening to people trying to sell them something rather than people trying to present a straight story. Solid investment advice should not change. It should stay, not just in bull markets. Passive stayed through the bull market without change. It should stay in bull and bear. And that's something the passive investors can't say. Passive investing is only popular. The idea of not paying attention to price is only popular during insane bull markets when prices are totally out of control. It's an extremist strategy packaged as a neutral, moderate strategy. Myth 21, rebalancing makes sense. Rebalancing just makes no sense. What is rebalancing? Rebalancing means when stock prices go up, that say you adopt a 70% stock allocation as your allocation. Rebalancing means if stock prices go up, then your allocation will be gradually increasing because the stocks in your portfolio are going up more than the non-stock part of your portfolio. And so over time, a portfolio that was 70% stocks will become 75% stocks and 80% stocks. Rebalancing means you just lower it back down to 70. Well, people, this is the answer. When you tell people valuations matter, they say, oh, I sell stocks when prices go way up. I rebalance. Well, it's a step in the right direction, but it's not nearly enough. If you rebalance, you're staying at the same allocation regardless of the price of stocks. That's the whole idea of rebalancing. But the reality is the long-term value proposition of stocks diminishes when prices go up. So you shouldn't be rebalancing and trying to stay at the same allocation. You should be lowering your allocation when prices go up and increasing your allocation when prices go down. That's valuation-informed indexing. That's the opposite of rebalancing. That's not rebalancing. Myth number 22. I need to speed up. Dollar cost averaging solves the price problem. Well, I think I already discussed that. I gave an example of dollar cost averaging. Dollar cost averaging doesn't solve the pricing problem. Because they talk about it, they say, oh, if you dollar cost average, you're buying some at high prices, some at low prices. No, if you were dollar cost averaging from January 1996 through October of 2008, you were buying stocks at insanely high prices for 13 years. You weren't buying sometimes high, sometimes low. There were little changes in price, but the entire time period, stocks were insanely overvalued. You need to look at P10 and find out what insane overvaluation is. And when you know that, you knew not to buy any stocks during those 13 years. Stocks offered a bad long-term value proposition for the entire time period. Dollar cost averaging didn't help. You were buying at insane prices and then at insane, insane, insane prices. And then back to only insane prices. None of that works. Myth 23. Investors can know themselves and therefore can know their risk tolerance. The one thing they say in passive investing about risk is they say each person has to examine their risk tolerance and decide on their stock allocation. We cannot know ourselves. It is true that we have different personalities and we have different risk tolerance. But our ability to know ourselves is greatly limited. So that's not the way. That's not the way. That doesn't do the job. What you need to do, we can get very little bit of a fix on our own propensity to accept risk or to panic. We can get a lot of insight by looking at how risky stocks are at any given time. That's the mine of gold. Because stocks are so much more risky when they're overpriced than they are when they're fairly priced. So the way to set your allocation isn't to look at your personal risk tolerance, which means psychoanalyzing yourself. Extremely hard endeavor. Doesn't work. The right thing to do is to psychoanalyze stock, but you don't have to psychoanalyze them. All you have to do is look at the price. The P10 level is the price. When the price is fair, stocks are a great long-term value proposition. When the price is insane, not so much. And you don't have to do any psych. You don't have to go to psychoanalysis school to figure out how to do that. Just look at a number. So forget this, you know, studying, putting yourself on a psychiatric couch stuff. It's a waste of time, and it's dangerous because it leads you to believe you're doing something to address the risk problem when really you're just fiddling. You're really not doing anything of any great consequence because the people who talk with the greatest bravado panic when prices go down. We see this all the time on discussion boards. Myth number 24. Long-term strategies are the way to go. Well, it's true in a sense, long-term is the way to go. But the reason why I call this a myth is most people who believe, if you took a survey and you asked people, is long-term the way to go? Most people would say yes. But they don't define long-term. And if long-term means 30 years, that's one thing. If long-term means 10 years, that's something very different. I would estimate that 90% of investors, when they hear long-term stock investing is the way to go, they're thinking 10 years is long-term. But the data shows that in 10 years, when you buy stocks at overpriced levels, you're going to be destroyed. And you have to go out 30 years to get a decent return. In 30 years, you'll recover. You know, that part of the passive investing mythology is true. And it's an important point. It's not a small thing. But unless you define long-term, it's more dangerous to say long-term is the way to go than anything else. If you define long-term, then yes, you can build an investing model on that insight. But you've got to define it or it's a myth. It's dangerous. Myth 25, going with the crowd is safe. You see, we humans usually make our decisions emotionally and then we use our minds to rationalize the decision we've come to. We're all scared of investing because we don't feel we understand it. And we know it's important and we don't want to lose our money. We don't want to look like fools. So our natural inclination is to go with the crowd. The stock investing is not difficult. Stock investing is not complicated. I wish you wouldn't let people tell you it is. It's not. It's fairly simple to understand. But there's one big curveball and it causes some of the, you know, smartest people in the world to strike out. That curveball is, it's when you see a lot of people waiting in line for a restaurant, that's a sign the restaurant is good. When, you know, 56 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. You know, if all these people like Elvis, there must be something there, you know. Maybe you won't like Elvis, but it's worth checking out if 56 million like him. Doesn't work when it comes to investing. When 56 million think stocks are, you know, best for the long term and buy and hold and all this gibberish, that's when stocks are most dangerous. When everybody's pumping them, run. That's when you're in trouble. It's dangerous. Popular stocks are dangerous. And stocks have never been as popular as they have been in recent decades when passive investing became popular. So they're most dangerous when people are promoting passive investing schemes. Going with the crowd is not safe. Going with the crowd is dangerous when it comes to stocks. If you understood that one myth, all the others would probably fall into place for you. Myth 26. If stocks scare you, you should get out of stocks. This is what a lot of people are doing today. They're saying, hey, stocks scare me. I'm better just putting my money in CDs or I-bonds or whatever it is. Well, you know, I've been trying to tell people to put their money in CDs and I-bonds for years now. But if you permanently put your money in CDs or I-bonds, you're going to hurt yourself. Because there are times when I-bonds have paid, you know, tips and I-bonds were paying up to 4% real at one time, but ordinarily they pay something like 2% real. Stocks ordinarily pay something like 6% real. So you're cutting your long-term return on your savings to a third of what it would otherwise be. If you were in stocks, you're going to delay your retirement by many years. The answer is not to just, the answer is not to be so pro-stock that you're unwilling to look at price, or to be so anti-stock that you're willing to give up two-thirds of your return. The answer is the middle ground. Of course you should invest in stocks. It's the ticket to financial freedom for middle-class workers. But no, you should not be willing to put your life savings into something without looking at the price and selling it. That's crazy. So the answer is not to get out of stocks. The answer is to learn the ABCs of stock investing, which means to learn that valuations affect long-term returns, the single most important thing there is to know to be a successful long-term stock investor. Myth 27, there was one right allocation that corresponds to every PE10 level. I have people ask me all the time, well, Rob, you say PE10 matters. Why don't you just tell us what stock allocation? Well, take today. We're at a 19 PE10 level. That's on the high side, not insanely high, but it's high. People will say, what stock allocation should I be at? Well, it depends. If you lost the, if say you were at a zero stock allocation before the crash, then if you put 50% in stocks today, you're probably going to be okay because we're probably going to see another stock crash in the next few years, a big crash. But if you can hold, if you understand valuations, then if you were to zero allocation before the crash, you probably understand valuations pretty well. You can get through that crash, and at the end of 10 years, you'll probably be okay. We're going to recover. Losses from today's value levels are not going to be permanent. They're largely temporary. Not totally, but largely. But if you lost in the earlier crash and you suffer another crash a year from now or 2 years from now, you're probably going to panic and sell everything at the bottom, which means you're going to be wiped out. You're never going to recover from that. So, you know, if you invested passively prior to the crash, I would recommend you be at zero stocks until you educate yourself about the effect of valuations on long-term returns. So I can't give you one number. I can't say 19 equals 50% stock allocation. It just doesn't work that way. People have to get that idea out of their head. What they're doing when they do that, you know, I did a podcast where I compared it to these 16-year-old boys, you know, that reduce women to measurements, you know. They're taking stock investing is not complicated any more than understanding women is complicated. It's complicated in a way, but we all understand people, you know, we're people ourselves, and stocks make sense. But they're a little bit scary. And when things are scary, we come up with these two-dimensional ways of looking at it. And that's what the passive investors do. They want everything reduced to a chart, everything reduced to a number. And it gets them in a lot of trouble. So don't do that. Don't think this can all be reduced to a number. And a P10 level of 19 is, you know, you got to understand more than one point. It's not insane. It's not as bad as it was before the crash. But it's not great. It's on the high side. We're likely to see another crash. And if you know that in advance and you're sure it won't bother you, stocks can be an okay value proposition today. But most of us don't. 9 out of 10 of us today have been influenced by the passive investing model. And if you're in that boat, you want to be cautious. You want to be cautious at today's 19. So 19 is not 19 is not 19. You know, Shakespeare said, a rose is a rose is a rose. It doesn't work that way with P10 levels. It's a myth that it should. 28, we know more about investing today than ever before. Well, we do and we don't. If you looked at the objectively, we have more information than we ever had before. So in that sense, we do. Trouble is, most of the things we believe today are myths. You know, is the internet a good thing or a bad thing? That's myth number 29. I'll mix that one in. The internet let us spread information in faster than we could ever spread it before. A lot of good it did us. The information we were spreading on the internet was advocacy of passive investing. It buried us. It made us dumb. Information isn't inherently good. I mean, good information is good. Bad information is bad. So what we've done is, by the internet coming along during the greatest bull market in history, the most insane out-of-control bull market in history, is we made all investors dumber than they've ever been before. We went to a P10 level of 33. That caused the Great Depression. This time we went to 44. Thanks to the internet. Thanks to academic research. Thanks to passive investing. Thanks to all these books. Millions of books. The idea isn't to write a book. The idea isn't to have lots of words and lots of charts between, you know, two covers. The idea is to get it right. And that's very different. So, yes, in an objective sense, we know more. We have more information. We've lost the capacity temporarily, I hope, to sort out the wheat from the chaff. And so right now, we in one sense, we know more than we ever did before. In another sense, we know less. We're more susceptible to the emotional get-rich-quick stuff, passive investing stuff, than we ever have been in history. That's 28 and 29, the knowledge level on the internet. Investing myth number 30. In 60, am I still under 60? Just about at the 60 mark. Panic is always a bad idea. No, panic is often a bad idea. Panic will kill you. But if you were panicking in 2008, thinking, this idea of not paying attention to price gives me the willies, I think we're going to see a crash, that was a good panic. That saved you. If you listen to that panic voice, panic can be the voice of common sense, trying to talk sense into you. So when you feel panicky, you should take a minute and think it through. You know, it's hard. It's not, you know, can you think, is it possible? Well, it's hard. You have to become self-reflective to know which panics are good and which panics are bad. But panic isn't always bad. He who panics first panics best. You want to panic when prices are at insane levels and get out before we hit bottom. You know, a lot of the most dogmatic passive investors of all time are going to panic, you know, late. And that's the worst time to panic. So panic is not necessarily bad. Those are my 30 investing myths in 62 minutes, something like that. I got close. Give me credit. Good luck with your investing strategies.